Good afternoon, welcome to Know Yourself. This is Dan Udell, and I've got a very, very special guest here today with me. I've got Ruth Fox. She is an author and a mental health advocate, and she's also a footballer as well. Ruth, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being here on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, honestly. It's not a problem at all. So, what we usually do is we start out with a little bit of like your origin story. So, you know, where do you come from? How did you, you know, what's your story? You know, who is Ruth? What's she about?
Yeah. So I'm kind of sensitive, and have been kind of all my life. And I thought for me, everything started mental health wise when I was about 14. I'd always been like happy-go-lucky kid, academic, sporty, had a lot of friends, and didn't really have a care in the world, really. So it really, really shocked me and confused me when I suddenly had, you know, a succession of days where I just cry. You know, just 2-3 weeks, you know, non-stop, and I had no idea why, because it was so kind of different to how I'd always been as a kid.
Yeah.
I was about 14 years old in year 9 at school, and my sister went to university, and I just found that kind of having her taken away from the family dynamic really, really difficult to deal with. At the same time, as you mentioned, I'm a footballer, so at the same time I picked up an injury, so I couldn't kind of relieve that, you know, stress and anxiety on the football pitch because I was injured, and it all kind of just, you know, caved in on me, and that's when I got diagnosed with depression. It was kind of like a word that I never, ever thought would, like, be associated with me.
Yeah.
Didn't really know what it was, didn't really know what mental health was, didn't know what mental illness was, so it all just came as, like, a real shock to me and my family and my friends and those around me. But, yeah, I was put on medication straight away, referred to therapy at CAM, the Child and Mental Health Service. And it was really horrific, like, the first few weeks before medication kind of kicked in. Like, I was kind of... school kind of told me that I had to be in school.
Yeah.
And it was just really, really hard to deal with. Like, I remember kind of driving to school with my mum in the car, crying, sitting with the school nurse at school for like half an hour, then driving home again and, you know, in floods of tears. And it was just like, that was my day-to-day life for like 3 or 4 weeks. And it was so hard because school has always been like an environment which I thrived in. And suddenly, you know, I couldn't even deal with being with around people or socializing with anyone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of recovered from that, luckily. Medication kicked in, and that was actually a real savior for me at that time. Finally, my CAMS appointment did come round, but I said, you know what, I don't want anything to do this anymore because I feel really well in myself.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want anything to do with the services anymore or medication or anything like that. Took myself off medication because... again, as a kind of 14-year-old, I just, you know, really didn't understand what medication would do to my brain and why I had to be on medication when no one else in my class was on medication, and why I didn't need medication for the last kind of 13 and a half years of my life, why suddenly now. So I really like, struggled to still kind of gauge an understanding of, you know, what mental illness was and how it would affect me. But yeah, as I said, I came out the end of that and... really truly thought that I'd been cured of depression and never would suffer from it ever again because it was so difficult. And I thought, like, I've been tested, I've been kind of, you know, gone through this adversity, you know, I'll never have to go through this again. No one had told me that mental illness was something that I might have to live with for the rest of my life or something that I might come up again. And I only learned that the hard way. So having, like, I got kind of 9 A stars, 2 A's in my GCSEs, was predicted 3 A's in my A-levels. You know, year 11 and year 12 at school were the best years of my life. And then in the first term of year 13, so probably the hardest, you know, academic year, competing with 3 A-levels, I relapsed. And I relapsed quite badly. So things just kind of took a turn for the worse. So I was self-harming, had suicidal thoughts. I was put on medication again, but this time it had like adverse effects, which was really, really hard to take.
All right.
I was not safe in the medication. One of the most prominent side effects of like the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which is a type of antidepressant, is suicidal thoughts. And I think, you know, I just think it's so difficult to deal with when you're already in a bad place, and then you take something you think is going to make you better, and it just makes you feel worse.
So,
I stumbled through school, but luckily I came across a teacher who I kind of confided in and spoke to literally most days, and he just listened to me and didn't judge, and just was, I don't know, was just someone that I really trusted and could talk to about anything, and wholly supported me through the rest of my school career. I made the decision with my family and the school that I wouldn't take any A-levels at the end of the year, so it was really, really challenging decision. You know, I'd been predicted 3 A's. I'd always been really, really academic, and suddenly, you know, I didn't have the certificate to prove, you know, the kind of last, you know, 13, 14 years of schooling had come down to nothing in my eyes, and I felt really disappointed, and I went to a private school, and, yeah, it was just really kind of, yeah, difficult to deal with on top of everything else.
Yeah.
When I turned 18, I was completely cut from services because it happens to a third of young people, normally are transferred from child and adolescent to adult services, but yeah, a third of people, just young people, are just kind of cut off the list, and unfortunately that was me.
Right.
As I said, like, I stumbled through the end of school with the help of this teacher who, like, devoted literally so many hours to me, just listening to me. Honestly, I owe him so much. I think we all should find, you call Mr. Donahue, we should all find our Mr. Donahue, someone who just, like, listens and is always there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I left school with no A-levels and kind of no plan, no ongoing psychological support or medication or therapy, and just had no idea what I was going to do. I kind of dabbled in a few ideas and came across the fact that I could enroll on a foundation university course on my AS level from year 12, which wasn't kind of the top unis I'd always, like the Russell Group unis I'd always wanted to go to, but, you know, it meant moving away from home, gaining some independence, a fresh start.
Yeah.
No one had to know what I'd been through before, so I was like, yeah, let's do this, I think this is a good idea. And for the first kind of 3-4 weeks of the term, it was a good idea. You know, I started excelling again at my academics, started playing like first team football, made a lot of new friends. But unfortunately, I feel like that was just a huge distraction from what was actually going on in my head. And yeah, within a few weeks, I was in need of help, really. I was like self-harming every day. I sought help from the university doctor.
Yeah.
He put me on medication again, and again had adverse effects. I remember this particular time I had to go to A&E because I had really vivid visualizations of overdosing.
Right.
And I remember going to A&E with a friend, and we waited 8 hours that night to be seen. I remember I was like really upset when I saw the mental health team, and they were like, we can't really see you when you're like this. Do you want to wait another 10 minutes outside? And I was like, you know what? I have to wait 8 hours. I'm not going to wait another 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And there were two guys. So there was like a kind of more senior psychiatrist and a younger kind of mental health nurse. And the senior guy said to me, so I threatened to overdose on the medication. The senior guy said, that amount of medication wouldn't kill you anyway. And the younger guy said, we're not going to come up with the help for you. You've got to come up with the help yourself. So I left A&E that night with no referral to any services, no referral to crisis team. Still felt very unsafe. Just felt disappointed that I'd, you know, asked for help, I called out for help, and no help was given to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not uncommon, unfortunately.
No.
And, yeah, it was just very, very difficult to kind of comprehend and deal with. And so I finally got round to seeing the head of mental health at the university, because I was missing lectures. I was, as I said, I was self-harming daily, and I had like a 2-hour appointment with him. And at the end of that, he referred me to the crisis team, the local crisis team, like, which was outside the university. It was in the town next door.
Yeah.
And basically, I got seen by the crisis team like every single day for about 4 or 5 days. They'd come between like 2-hour slots. And again, just found that really, really frustrating because a different person came every day, so you couldn't really build like a relationship with them.
I see. No, it's okay. I was just saying, I see what you mean.
Yeah, it's hard, especially when you're kind of, you know, you've had letdowns in the past. It's frustrating. So I remember on the Sunday, nobody came because apparently I wasn't on the high priority list. And not that many mental health kind of workers work on a Sunday, so no one came. They said they'd call me back, like they call me to kind of check in on me. And no one called me that day. I was meant to have a football match. We have our games on a Sunday, and I couldn't even play my game. Like every time I got in the car, I thought I was gonna crash myself. And I remember it got to like the evening, and again I was really scared about overdosing in my house. So I remember driving to like Tesco's, which was only like a mile or so away from my house, and I had no idea what I was meant to do. Tesco was shut because it was like a Sunday evening. I felt like really, really at risk and vulnerable.
Yeah.
So I texted one of my football coaches and I said to him, like, I don't know what to do. Like, this is the situation I'm in. I have no idea what to do. And he said, call an ambulance. And I've never called an ambulance like, in my life before. But I didn't really see any other options, so I did. And the lady on the other end of the phone was like, we can't send anyone out at the moment because all of the ambulances are out. But we can get home back to call you back, like a duty doctor to call you back within 2 hours.
Yeah.
I'm a very kind of goal-oriented person, so 2 hours, although it felt like a really, really long time, I knew I'd be able to get to the end of 2 hours.
Yeah, you could do the wait.
That's it, even though it was so difficult. So I did get to the end of the 2 hours, but it really needed matter because it was very mind. The 2 hours was up at about 1 a.m, and by 1:30, still no one had called me, and I just knew that no one would. So I got out of my car and like stood by a road and like contemplated jumping for like an hour. I remember people walking past, like students kind of walking past, and it just made me think, like, if I ever see someone kind of looking slightly vulnerable or on the edge, like, just always go up and just say, like, look, are you okay? Because that's what I needed at that time. So I'm really conscious of doing that for people now because no one did that for me in that time of need.
Yeah.
Luckily for me that night, I didn't do anything for myself. I went home in a state of physical and mental exhaustion. In that, all I did when I got home was sleep. And luckily, quite a senior person from the crisis team came the following day. So I was able to tell her what had happened the night before. And she then admitted me into hospital. So I was admitted kind of at the end of October in 2017. I was in a day unit, so you kind of go between like 8 and 3, and you have like therapy, your medication is given. And yeah, I was put on a new medication, so this would have probably been the fourth one I've been on. And unfortunately, again, it had the adverse effects where it made me feel worse before it made me feel better. So one night, so I was still at home during the night because it was only kind of a day hospital. I overdosed on the medication, which wasn't like a fatal amount or anything. But it was still quite bad, and I was taken off the medication. And yeah, after 3 weeks, I was discharged. And I think for me, this is like the most frustrating part of my journey and my story, and the bit that still kind of makes me frustrated now. So when I was discharged, I assumed that I'd go back to university, and that's what I discussed at the hospital. That's what I discussed at the uni, so I kept in touch with the uni and kept them up to date with how I was feeling, etc. But when I was discharged, I had a meeting with the university. The university and the hospital both refused to have meetings outside of their own organisation. So I had to organise them individually.
Right.
The university said that they didn't have the resources to support me, and that was their own words. So I was told to defer my place and move back home with my parents, which again was frustrating because I didn't have that choice. I wasn't given the choice. And also, I think if someone had a physical condition or a disability, they'd do everything they can to keep that person in studying.
Yeah.
But because it was a mental illness, that felt, you know, it was just somehow different. And I just think that, you know, with hindsight, that was just felt really, really wrong. so I had to move back in with my parents. And also, when you're discharged from hospital, you get given like a care coordinator who kind of overlooks your treatment once you've been discharged from hospital and going back into the community.
Yeah.
And my care coordinator was off ill for like 3 weeks after I got discharged, which wasn't particularly useful. So like, I rang up the team in which you work, and they like asked me what my address was, because obviously they were kind of identifying me, and I said Bedfordshire, which is where my parents live and I now live, and they said we can no longer support you because we're in a different county and we have different NHS funds which don't cross over.
Yeah.
So I'd gone from acute care and hospital to absolutely nothing within the space of, you know, like literally a few days. And I think that was for me when I reached my lowest point, because I'd had all my support taken away from me, from university and from hospital and from community mental health teams. And it was kind of like the end of November. I like attempted to take my own life twice. And, you know, had no support around me at all, to be honest.
Right.
Luckily, I managed to get out of that. In January, I finally got around to speaking to my GP, although it wasn't my GP. So I rang up for surgery at like 8 in the morning, as you normally do, to get an appointment for that day. And I was on a waiting list of about 23 other patients. Finally got seen. Finally got kind of got to speak to somebody. And it wasn't my doctor because they were fully booked. So I had to have a call from a random duty doctor who I'd never spoken to before. And basically she just prescribed me medication over the phone and said that someone would get in touch with me about therapy from the surgery.
Yes.
Which never happened. So I was on that medication until about March, and then I took myself off it. Because again, I just didn't want anything to do with the services at all. You know, since then, even since attempted to take my own life in November, I've not been in touch with any services at all, just because I've got a real lack of trust for them.
Yeah.
But luckily I found kind of my way and my direction through myself and those around me. So in January I also decided to write down my story, just get it off my chest, and just because like how dark it got, like no one knew about that except me, and I couldn't live with that going round and round in my head. So I wrote it down and then decided to self-publish it as an ebook in the hope that someone would read it who was in that same dark place. And yeah, just hope that it would help somebody. And then in March, a publishing company got in touch and asked me if I wanted to publish it in paperback, which I agreed to. And I've just finished writing it, which will be out in November. And yeah, now I guess, yeah, I speak to young people. I always pretend that I'm speaking to a 13, 14-year-old me, because I knew nothing about mental health.
Yes.
I always just imagine that, yeah, I'm talking to myself and giving a real, honest and genuine story about how difficult mental illness is, how dark it can get, but also that thread of hope at the end. Like, this is where I am now. You know, I'm a full-time mental health advocate and author and public speaker, and you know, I've got some exciting kind of events coming up as well. So yeah, I just want to share with people that, you know, it's okay to struggle. We all struggle. It doesn't show weakness. It shows more strength to open up and to ask for help. And despite the letdowns I've had by the services, there's always going to be someone out there who will listen to you, and you're never alone. So yeah, I guess that's my story, and up to where I am now.
Wow. That's a lot. So,
sorry.
No, it's really amazing that you've been able to speak about all of that. I appreciate it. Appreciate the like openness and the authenticity. It's just, it's a lot, and just like, well done you for like going through all of that and coming out the other side. Like, you know, did you ever have, like, any therapy, like, some talking therapy at all?
It's a good question. Like, quite a lot of people ask that. Like, no is the answer. It's quite stupid, like, because I've, you know, been, I guess, within, in and out of services years old. I'm now 19. But no, I've never had like ongoing therapy. I got offered cognitive behavioral therapy when I was 14, but I declined it because I felt really well in myself and, you know, didn't really want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
When I was in hospital, I had dialectical behavioral therapy, which is kind of similar. And also had, you know, a couple of sessions with a psychologist and a psychiatrist, but nothing like ongoing.
I see.
So I guess, sorry.
No, it's all right. I'm just agreeing with you. Yeah.
Even from being in hospital, things still just like I reached my lowest point after I was in hospital. So, you know, it's I think it's a story that is not uncommon because, I mean, we unfortunately do hear stories. Even I just came across one today where someone was let down for five services, discharged from hospital, and then went on to take their own life. I'm an unusual case because, you know, I've got a voice and I'm not afraid to kind of share what went on.
Yeah.
Even for example, like my discharge letter from hospital, on there it said, is the patient aware of their diagnosis? And they ticked the box no. So like, how are you even meant to try and get better if you don't even know what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I feel like there must be so many people in my situation where they feel unable to re-engage with services, but no one ever talks about them.
Yeah.
People assume that it's just easy. To pick up the phone and ring someone or anything like that, but it's not. When you've had, you know, it is a trauma, it's a psychological trauma, because you're in a really, really vulnerable position, you ask for help and it's denied, and it's not just once, but so many times. But no, I've not had any talking therapy. I've kind of had to gain a lot of self-awareness and self-insight through what I've been through, and just learn, you know, coping mechanisms naturally, kind of, for me, the gym, or football, or coffee, you know, out of the house somewhere, or reading something, and I think that's what it's like for most people.
Yeah.
It's just about finding the coping mechanisms that work for you and can see you through, you know, on a day-to-day basis.
It's interesting because I remember I went to my GP, I hadn't even told anyone how I was feeling really, or anything, because I was assaulted when I was 16, and it had a real effect on me. I didn't know what was going on. I just thought I was a freak of nature. Like, I thought that something was wrong with me and everyone else was fine. And like, I felt like I was the only person in the world that had this thing going on, where I was like afraid to go outside, and I would have like really bad nightmares, and my hands would always be like really sweaty, and I felt like I wanted to be sick all the time. And I remember I went to a doctor, I turned up to my GP, and I told him everything that was going on, and, you know, I said that I was having like suicidal thoughts, and, you know, I wasn't in a good place. I just really wanted some help. And he basically like gave me a leaflet about a charity which was like about 20 miles away from where I was that could like help me out. And I said, it's no good because like I can't, there's not even buses out to that place, like I can't go to that place that you're offering to me. I said, like, is there anything else you can do? And he was like, no, I'm afraid not. And I just remember leaving like really disheartened and just like thinking that that's it, that's all the help I'm ever gonna get, like, it's up to me.
I think it's common. Yeah,
so it's interesting and also a little bit heartbreaking that you've had that repeated over a number of, not just one visit, but like a number of visits, and in different circumstances after visits as well. Like, whether that be hospital or GP. I think it does still exist, like, these problems in the system. And I eventually got to the point where I was at the age of, like, I think I was about 19/20, I started paying for my own therapy, and it's probably cost me, well, it's definitely cost me thousands. I don't know whether it's tens of thousands yet, but I've been going for 5 years private because I didn't have faith in anyone else to, like, help me. So I guess I can kind of relate, but I also don't know how excruciatingly difficult it must have been to go through all that. So for me, what was the inspiration of writing it all down? What, you know, this genesis of the book, we'll get onto the book, but actually writing it all down, where did that come from? Was it an idea that you had, or was it a friend or a family member? Like, what happened there?
Just kind of came naturally. Like, one night, I just, like, went onto my laptop and just wrote that. I think I wrote, like, 7,000 words. Just, this is me, this is my story. I didn't write it for anyone, I wrote it just for me. I don't know, I just found it really kind of cathartic and, like, releasing to get it down on paper. It kind of brought it to life, like, because it was all going on in my head. And, like, for example, like, one night I'd written my suicide letter, and no one else knew about that, and it didn't feel real at all. Even though I still had it, like, in my house, I wasn't going to use it, but I still had it in my house.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel real. So I think for me, including that, it's very, very raw and, you know, genuine, and, like, you don't normally see suicide letters written unless they're being used. Not, you know, why I think I'm in a really lucky position now, because I didn't use it.
Yeah.
But I think that gives, I don't know, in a weird way, it kind of gives my book and what I wrote that night a unique kind of, I don't know, a unique part of it that, for me, just, that's everything. If I hadn't included that, it's almost like, I wrote this one night, you know, I just needed that to add some kind of, just to make it so real and genuine and honest, and this is exactly what I wrote, these are the thoughts that were going through my head, and I'm very lucky to still be here. So, I think just writing it down just came really naturally, and it wasn't until, you know, a few days, maybe a week later, that I thought maybe this could help somebody, and that's when I decided to self-publish it.
Yeah.
I mean, I used to write poetry when I was younger, just when I was going through difficult patches. So, you know, I've always found writing, you know, really, you know, good thing. And you know, I did that. Well, I didn't actually finish it. I did English A level as well. So
you've got a bit of writing, like, skills and abilities about you.
I don't know. You can judge that when you read the book.
So, what was the initial reaction when the ebook was published, and how did you promote it? You know, how did people find out about this?
So for me, I honestly didn't expect or do it for a reaction at all, and just wasn't prepared for the reaction that it got. So basically, I published it on Amazon, and just, I don't know, just, like, put it on my personal Facebook account and my personal Twitter, which at the time only had like 400 followers, and then people read it and really, really related to it for some reason, and, you know, my Twitter following, you know, started to increase, people started to retweet it, and you know, radio shows got in touch with me, so I've gone to Cambridgeshire, I've been on like 7 times now, RFM, Sky Sports News got in touch, and I've, you know, filmed a piece with them, and was also live on their show during Mental Health Awareness Week. And I've also been on a couple of other kind of local radio shows. I think quite a lot of all kind of sport relating media kind of were interested. So
yeah,
local papers, like, I remember I was on the back page of like Cambridge News, and and things like that, just because I was a female footballer who, you know, opened up about their struggles. And I was really, really shocked at the response, and even more shocked when, you know, the publisher, which is called Trigger, got in touch with me and said, would you like to publish this paperback? And I was, again, just like, why would anyone want to hear my story? I just genuinely didn't think it would kind of gain the traction that it did. Like, I remember when it sold 7 copies, I was really happy. So I was like, oh my gosh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's probably just 7 of my friends and family. But it went on to, you know, sell 350 copies. And, you know, I'm hopeful that the hard copy of the book will sell more. And now I've got to a point where I just want to impact as many people as I possibly can. And I hope that the book is a good medium of doing that.
Yeah.
So
just so people at home know, the book is called Within the White Lines, and on Amazon it's saying that the title's going to be released on November the 5th. So you can grab that your paperback or hardback copy from there. So what we'll do is we'll link up your I take it you've got a link for your ebook. We'll put that on so people can go and read it, because I think a lot of people would love to sort of read the words that you put down from your story. I think there's a lot of people that will be able to relate and also have empathy for you as well. Even from our discussion so far, like, I think you've got a lot of different themes that are going to help people, like students, you know, young adults that have like moved out. I just think it's great. So obviously you're published now and you're starting to do speaking events as well. What was that like for you, the first time getting up on stage and talking to a room full of people about this? Yeah.
One guy put his hand up and he was like, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say thank you. So basically he read a few of my tweets when he was in a really kind of dark, suicidal place. And he said to me, like, I genuinely think that you saved my life. And he'd driven like 55 miles just to tell me that. So, you know, that was a real heart-wrenching moment. Which
that's amazing.
Just, you know, a small amount of the strength that she showed me. And I just don't want any other young people to find their parents in that way, because, you know, no one deserves that, especially not, you know, a 12-year-old girl. So,
no.
Yeah. It's like things like that, where people open up to me after talks. You know, I've had a teacher come up to me, like, in tears afterwards. Like, it's things like that which just really stick with me. And it's not the physical things. It's not, like, the awards that you win or anything like that, or the followers that you have or whatever. It's those little emotional moments that really, really stick with you, and that's why I keep doing what I do.
It's that connection. It's that deeper level where the words that you say can, like you've shown here, they can literally change someone's life. And it's understanding that there's this thread that connects all of us, and it is mental health or like spirituality or whatever you want to call it. There's this deeper level that connects all of us, and we can all relate. Everyone, I genuinely believe that every one of us throughout our life is going to have something where it'll really make us question ourselves, and, you know, it'll either be like a mental illness or, you know, like a trauma that happens, and it'll make you face these things.
Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah. I think we learn the most about ourselves and about life through adversities, and you know, the amount of strength that we gain from that, you know, it is worth it, even though at the time it's so hard to see. I wouldn't be half the person I am now without having gone through what I have been through. Like, if I hadn't been through it, I would be currently at university, probably heading a textbook somewhere, you know, and be quite a closed person. Whereas now, you know, I talk about how I feel, I talk to other people, you know, I'm about to have a book out. Like, there's always going to be, like, as cliche as it sounds, light at the end of the tunnel. But with that light, you know, you gain so much perspective, insight, awareness. And hopefully can use that to help, like, impact other people's lives as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think it's so important to talk, and I think it's so nice that we've all got that ability now. Like, there's this movement happening where online people are really starting to talk and share, and yeah. There's a lot of conversations happening. I think that's why I love Twitter so much, is because it's a place where, even though I've been kind of comfortable with my own mental health now for a little while, it still struck me when I joined, and I looked and I thought, like, wow, there's actually a whole group of people here, like a whole community talking about it, and it's completely okay as well. So not only am I okay with it on my personal level with myself, but there's a whole group of people that are willing to accept me as well.
Yeah, totally. I think social media obviously has its places and has its pros and cons, but yeah, from what I've seen and from kind of what I tried to do on there and what other people are doing, like, you're right, there is, you know, a huge movement that's going on, and I think as a society we are definitely talking more, which is great, but I think the issue we have is, like, the services and the NHS are just so far behind that, and, like, yeah, we're so open, the media is so much more open, and celebrities and footballers and things are so much more willing to come forward, but, you know, it means that members of the public are also more likely to open up and come forward, but, you know, the services have then got to live up to the support that people are needing and reaching out for. So I always find it really hard when people approach me, but a lot of people ask me for help. And I kind of obviously suggest various things like GPs, marathons, whatever. It's so hard for me to kind of suggest the doctor or counsellor or wherever that might fall, like A&E, because of my own experiences and the letdowns that I've had. So,
yes.
You know, it's almost like you're passing someone on to something. It's a bit like mental health first aid. You know, that is an excellent thing, and I've done the course and everything, and I think so many more people should do it, but it just means we then hand over somebody who needs help to the services and the system. But, you know, there are so many gaps and flaws within the system that you almost feel like you've not done your job. So I think as a population and as a society, we just need to each individually be able to listen and to offer all the time in the world to someone that's struggling, because there will be flaws, there will be gaps in their treatment and their kind of care from the services, and we as a society have got to fill those gaps, even though it shouldn't be our responsibility, it just inevitably is. And
yes,
especially as more people struggle with their mental health, the services just cannot keep up with that.
Yes.
So I think, you know, that's where time is a real key thing. So just giving someone your time, listening to somebody, and it doesn't matter. There isn't a time span on it. It's not like, okay, just support this person for 2 weeks and then they'll have help or whatever. Like, just standing with that person until they don't need it anymore, or better still, just standing with next to them through everything, you know. I think I'll go back to the teacher that I had. Like, I never felt entirely alone. Even during the school holidays, he dropped me an email checking in with how I was, like even on Christmas Day. And I think we just all need to just give more time. We're so busy, we have such busy lives. But you don't realise that just one conversation could save someone's life.
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. So I think listening is such an underrated quality. And you really, when you're struggling, like I've been in this situation so many times where I've opened up to people, you instantly know if someone's a good listener or not. We just need people to be non-judgmental in their listening and not kind of be looking at their watches and being like, well, I've got a meeting in 10 minutes or whatever. Like, that meeting doesn't matter. You know, for the next, however long that person needs, that person needs to be the at the front of your focus. As I said, like, so many people are so busy, they just miss out on the kind of key indicators that someone's struggling. Like, someone saying, a student, for example, going up to the teacher, can I have a chat? And the teacher says, like, look, I've got loads of emails to do right now, can you come back at lunchtime? But that student might not come back at lunchtime because they felt like that was their only opportunity to talk to you there and then.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, and it, you know, might not be right, I'm not giving advice, but I just say drop everything. And, like, that student could be disclosing something about their past or their family life or their mental health or, you know, whatever. They might be at risk. So I think, yeah, in schools, in businesses, in shops, like anywhere and everywhere, we just need to look out for one another more and drop the professional titles. You're no longer, you know, a boss or anything like that. You know, you're all on the same level when it comes to supporting one another.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we often forget. So I think listening is
Yeah. I totally agree. You really do know when someone's engaged and listening properly, and it's having that conversation. I think it was you actually, Ruth. You sent out a tweet about having a conversation with someone and like them truly like listening to you and hearing and being with you in that moment. It's like such a valuable thing. And it kind of struck me, and it made me think, like, because like I'm training to be a counsellor at the moment.
Awesome.
Like, listening's like it becomes one of your superpowers. You end up doing a lot more listening than you ever do talking. It's kind of like 75% listening, 25% talking.
Yeah.
Because you understand that talking isn't just about turn taking, it's about allowing a space for that person to get their thoughts out, and sometimes it's okay to not even say anything.
Yeah, totally. And I think silence is another one of those things that, particularly, like, I don't know whether it's a British thing, like, I don't know, but we're just so awkward in silences. But I've had so many like phone conversations where the other person, like, I've called someone up because I really, really needed help. Like, it's not a professional, but someone I know, and like they've been silent for like 20 minutes, and like that's absolutely fine. Like, same when I've had face-to-face conversations with people, because you're, as the kind of person who needs help, you're just, you know, thinking about things, you might not have anything at all to say, which is absolutely fine. But just as you like rightly said, it's giving them that space, and to have someone sat beside you, whether that be in person or over the phone, silence doesn't matter, because it's about that presence. And sometimes that's all you need. I'm shorter marathons, like, spend hours just with silence on the, you know, talking to the person on the other end of the phone. Like, it's another thing. Like, we're just, it might be that somebody in an awkward silence might then start talking about themselves, when actually it's not about them, it's about the person in need. So I think that's so important, that we give that person the time and the space that they need. And if that means there's an awkward silence, then so be it. Like, we need to be uncomfortable sometimes. These conversations are not ever comfortable. But as I said before, like, they have the ability to change. It's not safe someone's life. So we've got to be more prepared to have them.
Yeah. I absolutely agree. What would you say to someone? So, what would you say to someone that doesn't currently have a support network, and they want to build up a support network of these kinds of people that will sit and listen and allow them to be who they want to be, you know, without judgment? What would you say to someone that really wants to build that network up?
Talking to. Maybe one of them could be Samaritan, which is 161-123 is the number, like, just because that's 24/7. But the other one could be, like, I don't know, someone from work, a friend, a family member, like, whoever it might be. It doesn't, what I always reiterate is that it doesn't have to be the person that you immediately think of. So, for example, I live with my parents. If I was going for a bad day, a lot of people would assume that I could talk to my parents, but for me that isn't possible because they just don't understand kind of mental illness and stuff like that. So
yes,
for me, I've got a whole host of other people I'll talk to before I talk to them. I think it's important to just know who those people are. I'll just say to that person, like, just don't be afraid to have a conversation. You know, there's always fear of judgment and fear of, oh, well, I'll look weak or I'll look stupid or feel stupid or whatever. But honestly, the person that you've decided to open up to will be so kind of, pleased is the wrong word, but grateful that you've opened up to them, that you can trust them, and, you know, they'll think kind of so much of you that you have the courage and the strength to be able to talk about whatever you're going through, and that you've chosen them to speak about it. So I think, support network can obviously be professionals as well, so maybe your therapist or your doctor might be within those five, but I think it's important that you don't have too many people, because you can get, like, contradicting kind of views and advice and suggestions, which can all get a bit overwhelming.
Yes.
So I think, just don't be afraid to just talk to the person that you kind of trust, and it doesn't have to be, you know, the person that everyone thinks it should be. Like, that's totally up to you. And I think it's important that we have a support network, even if we don't necessarily need it. So I always say to people, like, when you're well, sorting out a plan, like a safety plan and a support network for when you're perhaps unwell, is a really good idea, because, you know, you're in a straight-headed place right now, got a clear head, and it's so much easier to then sort out where you go to get help, and not wait until it gets to the kind of crisis point before you reach out.
Yes. Like, almost having, like, a first aid kit for, like, when you're having a bad mental health day.
Yeah, I think obviously looking after yourself is so important, and kind of recognising when things are starting getting on top of you, just knowing where to turn. I think overall, like, as a society, we just need to talk about how we feel more. So, like, if we're having a bad day, like, say that we're having a bad day, because if we're honest with that, and we say, I'm having a bad day, and then we have another bad day, and then another bad day, someone's going to pick up on that and say, you've had quite a few bad days, like, is everything okay?
Yeah.
Whereas if we just say, look, I'm fine, no one's going to say anything. So I think if we're honest and open about how we feel all the time, people will pick up on trends, and therefore people can then prevent things from deteriorating further, and you can get help earlier, and then, you know, that will save kind of things getting really bad, in my opinion anyway.
Yes.
So I think, just being more honest with how we feel and knowing where to turn when we feel a certain way is really, really important.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. So, I kind of I'm in a bit of a spot where I've worked a lot through therapy on like myself and being comfortable in my own skin, and mm-hmm. what it's meant is that I feel as though I can do certain things like go to the cinema on my own or like take myself out for a coffee, and that's kind of like my me time, and yeah. I kind of value it more than ever at the moment because I just like my own company and it allows me to think and recuperate from the week and yeah, just like reflect as well. What would you say to someone or a group of people about self-care, like how to look after yourself and mm-hmm. promote I guess like better mental health?
Yeah, I think self-care is one of those kind of buzzwords at the moment. I think it is really important. Like I don't ever describe like maintaining my own positive health as self-care, just because I don't put the two together, although they are the same. I don't know why, I just don't like the word.
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's just all that I could think. It's the only word I could think of how to describe it.
No, it's cool. I think we should create our own word. We'll get you to think about that.
I call it like me time, but I don't know what everyone else calls it.
I think whatever you call it, like it's so important. I think to be honest, so many of us like put everyone else first all the time. But I think I always think back to the kind of two analogies. One is like the cup, like can't pour from an empty cup, like let other people fill up your cup first and then you can then go on and fill other people's cup. And also like the oxygen mask, so the first kind of thing that they have on when they're going through like the same safety thing when you're flying is put your safety mask, oxygen mask on before even your child.
Yes.
Because I mean, it feels so, like, I imagine, like, I've not, fortunately, touched wood, not been in a plane crash yet.
Yeah.
I imagine, like, it just feels so wrong to do that, and then when that is your child is your everything, and your world, but you're all going to function better when you've got your mask on, then you can help them instead, and that is just life. Like, I remember when I used to do, like, first aid, but I was in scouts and we did first aid badges, and it's like the first thing when you're approaching a scene is always looking out for danger for yourself.
Yeah.
Because the police would so much rather find one injured person than find two. And that's how you've got to think about it. Like, for example, I have loads of kind of people who might be at risk or suicidal approach me, or I might read articles and things like that, which might be triggering for me. And again, like, if something's going to make you in a worse place than you are, like, it might be best just to hand it off to somebody else or ask them to seek professional help or whatever it might be, because, again, like, if it risks putting you at risk, then again, like, that's even worse because then you need help and it's just kind of a negative spiral. So I think the things that you do in your day-to-day life, a lot of people do things like meditation, mindfulness, stuff like that. I haven't really incorporated that into my daily life yet, but you never know.
Yeah.
Just like taking time for yourself. I have one day a week where I do non-mental health related stuff, so that's a Thursday for me. So I spend like limited time on Twitter, and also unless I've got a talk that specifically booked on Thursday, I try and keep Thursday free, so I help out with like 4K football, which is for like over 55, and I help out with like senior citizens afternoon tea. So like completely un-mental health related stuff. And I always say that to particularly mental health advocates, campaigners, it can be so draining, go through your own story time and time again. Sometimes, twice a day, for example, if I had a radio interview and then gave a talk, like it can be quite exhausting just going through like your most difficult times so often.
Yes.
And that is almost like your job. So I always say to people, like, do something else that's not mental health related, because it can get so kind of encapsulating. You just can't everything you do, like even when you talk to family and you're talking about your day, you're still going over it again. So yeah, I always say to people, like, find something else that's not kind of mental health related. Obviously physical activity is great, so the gym is always great. Like, especially for women, I always say, like, yeah, going to the gym doesn't make you like bulky or anything like that. Like, it can be such a great kind of self-improvement thing, and you get so much stronger. And yeah, just to be honest, for me, it's a real safe place. I go to a really like laddie gym, like loads of male like bodybuilders and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't really care. Like, I love to do, I do my own stuff, and people, you know why people just, like, respect that. Like, yeah, it really doesn't matter. Like, you're always scared of being judged, but that never ever happens, because all people feel the same. Even the bodybuilders feel the same. So like, you're all in your own little world, and you can all do your own thing. And yeah, it's almost just a step out of reality. I always enjoy my time in the gym because I can switch off from everything else. Even just going out for a walk with headphones in, listening to music, again, just completely going out in the world. Find a good book that you can get completely lost in. And I always enjoy, like, a drama or something like that on TV, where you are literally, again, just anything that you, like, completely take yourself out of the world, so you're suddenly seeing this drama for an hour, you completely forget about everything else. But yeah, I think for me, it's about getting myself away from the thoughts and almost like distractions. But for a lot of people, it might be like, as I said, mindfulness, meditation, also like taking a bath, maybe doing some cooking, some baking, whatever it might be. I always like those kind of things, like art and stuff like that, writing, where you've got something at the end of it.
Yes.
Really rewarding. Because I remember at school, like, you used to always make something and you get to take it home. And you always feel proud of it, and then you get to a stage in your life in school where suddenly you stop doing that and get homework, and you know, you've got essays to write and exams. And but it's a real shame, because there is something so gratifying about taking home like a pot or, I don't know, other stuff that you've made at school and just showing your parents. And yeah, we lose that after a while. So I think making something is always nice, and having projects and things like that. So I think, yeah, looking out for yourself is so much more important than we probably think it is. And should be at the top of everything that we do.
That's awesome. I really liked that answer, actually. Like, my escapism, I think, is, because I agree, like, it can be a bit all-consuming. Like, I mean, on this morning, I spent 2 hours on Twitter, and I was like, whoa, that's, like, 2 hours gone. And it can be, like, all-consuming sometimes, because you can give, but then there's nothing left for yourself. So, like, I really try and regulate that by, like, just deploying self-awareness, and, you know, like, my escapism's, like, Netflix, or, like, it might be, like, just dropping everything and going downstairs and talking to the family for a bit, or, like, you know, like, ringing someone, or, like, I totally agree. I think it's just, I really like that you have, like, a day where you just do, you know, like, for example, you did the football, and I saw on your Twitter you did the, I think it was for elderly people, you did, like, a tea party type thing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, so much fun, yeah. And it's just a different generation of people, and I think, yeah, I get so much out of it, and I think, you know, they do as well. It kind of just brings you back down to earth, and yeah, I just want to give back to people, and to be able to do that in another way, not through kind of mental health stuff. And I mean, they're always asking about what I do and stuff, so it's another conversation starter, but it's not the reason why I'm there.
Yes.
And I think you gain an awful lot out of just helping out with something. And again, I think it's kind of lost sometimes.
So talk a little bit about football. Like, where did the passion for football come from?
So I think it's from my dad. So me and my dad used to play at the field, like, all the time when I was about 7 years old. And then I joined a team, and it was a boys' team because there weren't any girl teams for that age group at all.
Yeah.
I remember kind of, the boys didn't think I'd be able to play, so I was, chucked in goal. And I had to prove a point that I could play, in training and stuff, and got to the point where I'd play half a match in goal and then half a match on pitch, and then finally could play on pitch for the whole game. And then, about 11 or 12, I moved to a girls team for the first time, and captained that and really, really loved it, and then moved on to the league leaders. So just wanted to be playing kind of at a higher standard. And then in 2013, I got selected to play for the Independent Schools Football Association. So kind of all the top players from private schools in England kind of played together, we trained up in George's Park, and played against kind of Australia, Scotland, and people like that. And that was actually marked the end of my football career, or so I thought. So that was when I first went through a really difficult patch, when I first got diagnosed with depression. And I just really found the social side of football just so hard to deal with, and couldn't really join in with the camaraderie of the team. So I quit football for 2 years. And only came back in the summer of 2016, where I joined my local team, which I played for a season, and then joined Cambridge United last season. Played for them again. It was a difficult season off the pitch because I was in and out of hospital and loads of stuff going on. But I made a promise to myself that I would not let my mental illness take football away from me for the second time. So I kept playing through it all. So some days I'd get back from A&E at 4 in the morning and still play a game at 2 the next day.
Wow.
Same day. some times I couldn't train because I just thought I'd crashed my car on the way to training on purpose, and some games I didn't play. But I tried to kind of keep that as my constant throughout this difficult year of my life. I've just recently left Cambridge United because I just wanted a completely fresh start. On trial at the moment at a couple of places. So, in the process of finding a team at the moment. I think for me, as I said, the first time I started struggling, I had to just stop playing. And I think that's okay. I'm a firm believer of do what you enjoy, and if you don't enjoy it, don't do it. That's definitely what I felt at that time. Through the kind of the second and most recent kind of struggle, that episode that remained my constant, and I was very, very lucky to have had football and to have had that kind of been on, and always an escape for me for that 90 minutes of the week.
Wow, yeah. It's like you get to step out of your life for a moment to just do 90 minutes of what you love doing.
Yeah, totally, exactly.
Yeah. And have the coaches and other members of football, have you ever been able to, I know you mentioned one of the coaches that you reached out to when you were having a tough time, have you ever been able to reach out to them further for any help and felt comfortable talking to them about your mental health?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've always been quite open with my football coaches. Throughout last season they were incredibly supportive and kind of on the end of a text message or if I speak to my training whenever I wanted to, really. I think the club itself, when I first opened up about my mental health, the only thing that was offered to me was a chaplain, so speaking to a chaplain, which is the only mental health support they have for both the men's and the women's team. Bearing in mind, the men's team at Cambridge United is fully professional and plays in League 2, and the women's team is fourth division. So for me, I said, I don't want to speak to a chaplain, I'm not religious, and I don't have mental health qualifications in any way. Try to change the kind of way that the football club offers support to players. So more recently, I've been involved with like secondary school kind of sessions that they run within the community to raise awareness of mental health for the community. But in terms of actual players and what support they're offered, I spoke with the director of football there, and we're now in the process of initiating 10 football coaches or members of staff to be mental health first aid trained.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I really saw that as a huge gap, because what the support that was offered to me, although my football coaches were incredible and gave me so much time, it wasn't good enough, like, outside of that. Some football coaches wouldn't have offered that and would feel uncomfortable with me talking about, you know, the difficult, particularly difficult days, like suicidal thoughts, self-harm, stuff like that. I was very lucky that my coaches were very open to talking about that stuff, but some won't be, and therefore there needs to be some understanding. And that's why, you know, I was really keen. Even though I don't play for the club anymore, I'm still quite heavily involved in the work that they do within mental health, and I just really, really wanted to see a change in, if a player opens up about their mental health, a chaplain is not enough. And I was really honest with that, and I said, like, that is just not enough.
Yeah.
And my aim overall is to get every single football coach in the UK mental health first aid trained, or at least have a unit on their level one coaching that incorporates mental health. So yeah, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to make that happen, but yeah, I can only do so much. But yeah, I just hope that we can all move with the times and recognise that players are in need of emotional support as well as physical support.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that you've got that as like a long-term goal as well. I think that's awesome.
We can only try.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about mental health in the workplace. Because I don't know, I think this is a little bit of a topic at the moment as well. Without meaning to bring that up. So I've divulged in previous workplaces that, you know, I've struggled with my mental health, and, you know, I let my line manager know, or, you know, and it impacted me in a negative way. It didn't help me. Like, I was overlooked for positions, for example, because, and I was actually told that as well, because of what I disclosed to them in confidentiality. Mm-hmm. What's your take on mental health in the workplace and the current state of it?
I think, again, like, workplace well-being is like a buzzword at the moment. And although it's great, I think, again, it just feels like another kind of tick-box activity, like, oh, we've got a workshop about workplace well-being, or we've got resilience training, or whatever it might be. And I think, again, like, as I said earlier, you know, nothing can kind of come before just, like, listening to somebody. And, yeah, it's hard for me because I've not really had too much experience within the workplace. Having, like, left school this time last year and kind of been involved with uni and stuff like that. But I think there's always more that we can do, and I think, yeah, things like mental health first aid are really, really key, but it can't just be that. It can't be like, well, we've got one mental health first aid during the workplace, that's it, we're sorted. Because what if people don't get on with that person, or what if that person's on leave, or whatever. And also, you're not actually given any, like, formal qualification as a mental health first aider. You can't offer therapy or prescribe medication or anything like that. So I think overall, the whole society, and that obviously includes workplaces, just needs to gain an understanding of mental health, mental illness, how it affects an individual, and being able to offer support, whether that's for listening or helping that person to seek external help, so important, and just being so, like, non-judgmental.
Yeah.
Because I think to be honest, it all stems back down into schools. Like, I always say this, but schools need to be doing more to talk about mental health, and that's why I go into big schools and young people, because I never knew anything about and I only knew about it because I went and had to go through it. So I think we've got to, you know, tell young people that we all have mental health. You know, one in four of us are going to, you know, have mental illness in our lives at some point. I think, you know, even when I was at school, we did like math percentages. We always spoke about cancer and our likelihood of getting cancer. And, you know, it needs to be the same. We need to be able to talk about mental health in the same that way it was about physical health. So I think it all does stem from schools, and the more open we are and the more that we can prevent things from happening early on, I think it's something like 60% of mental illnesses will stem before a young person is 14 years old.
Yes.
So for me it's prevention before intervention, so it shouldn't have to get to a point in the workplace where someone needs to take time off work if we've supported them. I mean, obviously it will in some cases, and that's absolutely fine. But if we support people from as early on as possible, it might be something they're able to manage, and it might be that we are able to offer more flexible hours or, you know, things like that, which I think it's about working with the individual and not having like a one-size-fits-all. It's no good, you know, writing out a policy or writing out something, this is what we follow when someone struggles with mental illness in the workplace, because individual and every single situation is different, and we've got to adapt to that person, listen to their needs, and just offer as much support as we possibly can.
Yes. It's that empathy, isn't it? It's like I say, taking it on a case-by-case basis and sitting down with someone and saying, look, I don't know what you're going through, but help me understand, you know, so we can support you as best as possible. Help me understand by telling me exactly what's going on, and I will listen. That's all I'll do. I'll listen, and then we'll talk about what you want to do. And I think there's not enough of that, and especially in corporate world, sometimes I think there's it can come across quite cold, and there's a lack of compassion, especially in the larger organisations, because, you know, some people feel like they're just a number. I think these organisations have to show that they actually have line management and like senior managers that do care and are compassionate and are also approachable as well.
Yeah.
Like creating that environment where someone can actually stick their hand up is just as important as the, like, compassion and empathy itself. And it sounds like for you, a big part is the education. So helping people understand, like, what mental health is, at a young age. It sounds like you want to focus more on those materials that are given to children and teenagers. So do you see in the future mental health becoming a subject in school on its own, just as you've got PE, which is physical education?
Within like PSHG, and I think that's great, but again I'm just concerned that it will be kind of tick box thing that we've done this now, which I think is good that we're actually doing it in the first place, but I just think, I don't know about it being a subject in itself. I think it slightly does differ from PE, physical education. I mean, yeah, of course I'd love that, but I just think we're too far away from that. At the moment, I just think we need to incorporate looking at emotional resilience and in primary school. I think that's important in year kind of 5 and 6. And I think looking at the transition between year 6 and 7 and incorporating mental health within that, and then secondary schools, just speaking more about mental health, mental illnesses in particular. And where to get help, where to seek help. This is okay to go through difficult times. You know, looking at exam stress, I think overall the government just needs to, I don't know if it would happen, but focus less on exams and results, grades. You know, I've always been an A star student, and I don't have any A levels now, and I'm still going to be a published author. you know, for me, I always try and put across that health and happiness comes before education, and success is not measured by the number of grades that you have, the qualifications that you have, the job that you have, the income that you have, the car that you have. It's about the character that you are and the impact that you have on the lives of other people. And then as a society, we really need to look at that, and the pressure to go to university and to, you know, being 30 grand worth of debt, and you know, I just think there's so much more that the government can be doing to promote positive mental health, like not focusing so much on exams. Like, we need to be learning because we enjoy learning, and
yes,
I think that's so important. Like, that's lost when you take A-levels. Like, you learn to pass an exam.
You're almost jumping through a hoop and ticking a box yourself.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. And I really appreciate that point that you brought up as well about kids understanding. Like, I didn't go to uni. I actually couldn't get in because I failed my A-levels. So my first year I did okay in my A-levels. I got like a B and like a couple of C's and a D. It was all right. It wasn't terrible. It wasn't amazing either. And the height of my anxiety and my PTSD was in my second year of college, so year 13, I guess. And I really struggled staying in school, because school where I went to high school was also where the sixth form was, and I really struggled to stay after sort of 12 o'clock, after midday, because I knew there'd be people around in the streets, and there'd also be, like, you know, people on their lunch breaks and stuff like that, and it really, like, made me nervous, and my anxiety was also at its highest when it was at the end of the day when I was leaving, because everyone would be leaving at the same time. And my head was always like, well, this is the perfect time for someone to get me if they wanted to. So for that reason, I my absence, like, went through the roof, because I just, as it got closer towards the end of the day, I couldn't handle it. So I started missing lessons. And I also didn't really care that much for my A-levels. So I didn't do very well because of that as well. And what it meant is that on results day, I literally got 3 U's and 1 D, which was actually in English language. So I remember being devastated and feeling that people around me were disappointed in me. But I went on to get an apprenticeship, and I did really well in the workplace, and, you know, I kind of worked my ass off for like 7 years, and I've got into a really good position now. And it just goes to show that there's not one path. There's not one way. You know, you could start a business, you could go work for a charity. There's so many paths, but we're only told one narrative. And I think it's important to get that message across to, like, kids and, like, teenagers, to say, like, there's so many different routes. Like, yes, there's the way that the system wants you to go, and it's good for these reasons, but there's also all of these different avenues as well.
Totally, yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, I didn't know another way. Like, I thought it was GCSE, A-level, uni, career, and that's just, you know, that's what my family did, that's what all of the rest of my kind of classmates did. I just thought that was the way, and I only, you know, diverged from that path because of the difficulties I went through. And again, it shouldn't be like that. Like, A-levels aren't for everyone. I always thought they would be for me, but in the headspace I was in, they weren't. And I think we've just got to realise that that's absolutely okay. Like, whatever you're doing now is absolutely okay. And, like, we all find our own path, and whatever drives you, whatever your passion is, like, the ideal is to have a job that you don't even call your job, because you just love it so much. And
yeah,
I think too many people are, like, stuck in 9-to-5 jobs, and they're counting down till Friday, and then they get drunk at the weekend so they can forget about their problems, and then dreading Monday again. And that's just their life, and looking forward to holidays and things like that, like, which is obviously fine, and you can look forward to the weekend, obviously, and you can look forward to holidays, obviously, but, you know, we've also got to be in an environment daily where we're thriving and, you know, getting the most out of ourselves and out of each other, and it really doesn't have to be that straight path that, you know, we're told from an early age, this is what you're meant to do. I always say we've all got our own path, just follow yours and see where it leads.
Yeah, exactly. Totally agree. I always just remember thinking I was just a screw up, and then I actually started working and earning money and going to college at the same time, and the stuff that I was learning, because I could apply it to something that was in front of me, my day to day job, I was I'm actually really good at this, and I'm earning money to go and buy pizza and stuff. This is great. I just think there's so many different ways. And it's nice to see from your point of view as well, because, you know, obviously you got a book out, there's a certain sense of business mindedness that comes with that. I didn't want to say entrepreneurship, because I don't want to just label it as that. But it's nice because, you know, you've got a career now out of this if you want it, and you can, you know, build a name for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, who knows? I don't know. I just take it day by day and see where it leads. But yeah, I mean, my aim and what gets me up in the morning is just the ability to be able to impact somebody and stop someone having to go through what I've been through. And that will remain my goal. I just try and reach my full potential in everything that I do.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that it will lead to a career and the next kind of stage of my life. But yeah, just right now I just take it day by day and try to impact as many people as I possibly can.
Yeah. What would you say to someone that has a bit of a story themselves and they think it might help people? What would you say to them about getting started, spreading their awareness of, you know, I spoke to a girl on Twitter the other day, and she has this disorder where when she's anxious, she loses the ability to talk for days, sometimes even weeks, and I didn't even know this existed until I read her blog. And I just said to her, you know, just whatever you do, don't stop what you're doing. Because I had no idea, literally no idea until that day that I read her, blog, that this was even a thing. And if I saw someone, I don't know, on the train or something, and I said hello, and they didn't say hello back, you might think that they're rude or something. You just don't know what's going on for them, though. And, you know, so what would you say for someone that's got a bit of a story and they're thinking about raising awareness?
First of all, I'd say there's absolutely no pressure to it at all. It's a big thing to kind of put all your most vulnerable parts out there, and it's not an easy thing to do, and there's absolutely no pressure from anyone to ever do that. But if you feel like it's a really positive thing, it'll benefit you first and foremost, but also benefit other people, then I just say go for it. Whatever it might be, whether you create a YouTube channel, Twitter, Instagram, write a blog, write poetry, write a book, whatever it might be, I don't know, just be as honest and real as possible. People respect honesty. Your story could be the key that unlocks someone else's, and I think you'll be really empowered by the response, hopefully. Just try and connect with like-minded people. I generally think people really respect genuine and honest people. Stories, difficulties, adversities, and nothing to be ashamed of, and you know, they help to mould us into who we are today. So never be ashamed of your story. And yeah, don't be afraid to share it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thank you. So I think it was really interesting that you mentioned poetry, actually, because I've always found, before I even considered therapy or anything like that, I used to listen to, I still listen to a lot of music, and I really appreciated the lyrics, because one song could convey like a whole range of different emotions or things that you're feeling. And I think it's the same with poetry. I think I always secretly liked it a lot, especially doing my A-levels, because like the really powerful emotions that it can convey. You said that you used to write poetry.
Yeah.
Do you still do that now? It was just for you. It was your own satisfaction, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There was one that was called like Smile High Door. And yeah, that just kind of portrayed the mask that we wear all the time. You know, I still do it now, like just smile at everyone and laugh at everything. And, you know, that might not convey how you're feeling inside. I think you're right about song lyrics and stuff. Like, I had one particular song in hospital that I just literally listened to, like, on repeat. And, you know, I think people connect with songs, and, you know, if I ever listen to that song now, it really takes me back into hospital, which isn't particularly nice, but it kind of reminds me how far I've come. And I think we all have those songs where, yeah, the lyrics really, really click with us. And I've got one that I actually listened to on the day that I knew I'd relapsed. And it's one of the reasons why I knew, because it was The Climb by Miley Cyrus, and it was like, there's always going to be another mountain.
Yeah.
That lyrics really, really clicked with me. I was like, this is something that I've got to go through again, even though I never thought I would have to. So I think, yeah, songs, poetry, whatever it might be, just connect with people, and can be a way of expressing how we feel, most definitely.
I like that you mentioned actually they do have this amazing power to blast us back in time to the point where we felt that first emotion about that song. It's really powerful. And it's interesting you mentioned about relapse as well, because I remember when I was going through therapy and also like working on myself as well, I always just thought like, oh, this is it. It's going to, you know, going to be a one-time thing. I'm going to be fine forever now. And then I remember my first, like, you know, my first relapse, like my first proper, like, I guess like an anxiety attack, like after I started therapy. And I just kind of remember thinking like, God, like you screwed me over, but you know, she didn't, my therapist didn't, because I didn't appreciate the fact that, you know, this is something I've got to manage and live with for the rest of my life. And I've got to be on top of it instead of it being on top of me.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's these speed bumps, I guess, that happen as you go throughout like life. What I find is that these like relapses, they become more frequent but smaller as you learn how to like manage them. And each time you learn like more about yourself, like more about yourself, and then when they come along, they last for days or hours instead of weeks and months. Like I went through one at the start of like this year, and it took me like 2 months to get over it. And then I had something happen to me a couple of months ago, and I was fine in like a day. So there is like progress that can happen, like you can like develop yourself. Like reading books always really helped me. Like there's a book called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, by Susan Jeffers. I don't know if you've ever read it.
No, I haven't.
Have there been any books like that, Ruth, that have helped you?
I guess Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig, probably one. But I don't know. I think for me, in terms of books, I don't really normally read them as like, I guess self-help books is probably the wrong term, but that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I guess they are.
Yeah, I prefer reading books that put me in someone else's world for a bit and nothing to do with mental health at all.
Okay.
Just because that's the relief that I get from them, as opposed to, yeah, reading about other people's stories is good. Like, I recently read Johnny Benjamin's book, which is great, but it's better because I read it in a more stable position. But I feel like if I read it when I wasn't in a great place, then, you know, it could have potentially done more harm than good just because it would trigger stuff in for me. So I think, yeah, I don't know. You know, people are so different and, you know, what works for one person might not work for another. So I think, yeah, as you say, it's just about, like, learning about yourself and what works for you.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, journaling and like stuff like that works for some people, where it like really doesn't for others. Like, I know people that like will turn to art and they like, you know, that's like their therapy, where they literally have like a canvas and, you know, they finish like a few hours later and they feel like they're in a better place because of it. Like you said earlier, there's not one size that fits all of us. And I guess it's about getting that message out.
Yeah.
So I just really wanted to like say like thank you for like coming on the show today. I've had a really, I think this has been like a really interesting chat, and I think that there's going to be a lot of people that will get benefit out of it, or a new insight about going through the system and, you know, like being on medication, for example, as well. And also, you know, going from 2017 to being in a really dark place to 2018, where you'll be a published author. I think that's a pretty good transition to go through.
Sometimes it's just a case of hanging on. You know, you could have all the support in the world. Sometimes you just got to hang on during those really, really dark nights, and that's definitely what got me through.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing that there's going to be a tomorrow and, like, you know, getting through that in your own way.
Mhm. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Like I say, I appreciate you coming on, and I know I'll be getting the book when it comes out, because, I mean, the first sort of like 20 minutes of this podcast, when you were explaining your story, I was just like fixated. I almost didn't know what to say afterwards, because it was just such a engaging story, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading it, and I hope other people do as well, because I think it's important. You know, I know the NHS is getting a lot of stick and stuff like that at the moment, but it's important for these stories to come out, because then it's the way that they aren't going to happen again. And
yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Like, I've got in touch with my local MP and kind of shared with him my experiences.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll take it higher in that sense, but it's just something that takes, you know, a long time, and, you know, lives are lost because of it, and I think that's the most frustrating thing. But I always remember, yeah, like, I'm lucky to be here, and if I can be a voice for those who aren't, then I will be, and I'll do all I can to stop other people from reaching that level of despair that, you know, I know so well, and so many other people do,
yes.
Because they felt so let down. So, yeah, I think there's a huge way to go. We are moving in the right direction, but sometimes it just takes you know, a whole herd of people to share their experiences and be honest with people, and hopefully that will encourage change.
Yeah, this like cultural like perspective shift that's going to happen. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today, and you, thank you for your time. Is there anything you want to say before we, you know, we say goodbye?
Not really. Just, yeah, thanks so much for having me on. And, yeah, hope that talking about my experiences, it can help other people know that there is in the tunnel and things do get better.
Yeah. Alright. Thank you very much. This has been Know Yourself with Dan Udell and Ruth Fox. Until next time, guys, peace out.